When I mention the word Australia, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Culture, of course. Think of it as the land of Clive James, Jermaine Greer, Barry Humphreys, Sir Charles McCarris, Dame Joan Sutherland, Nick Cave, Kylie Minogue. But it's also, of course, a great sporting superpower. And there's no sport that's quite identified as much with Australia as cricket. They have been historically rather good at it. And we can see how good they are over the next month or so when they return to England to play in the Ashes Test, one of the oldest and most mythologised sporting contests on earth. And on this week's EI Talks, we're looking at cricket, both the forthcoming Ashes series and cricket in the wider world, not least on the Indian subcontinent, which has become the major power player in the sport, introducing wholly new formats that could never have been imagined by the people who played in those first Ashes tests. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, deputy editor at EI. And I'm going to throw you a bit of a googly, Alistair. We have an international audience, many of whom will never have seen a cricket match or even on television. And I wonder if you could explain what are usually seen as the formidably challenging format and rules of this most complicated but also most compelling sport.
It's even more of a curveball because you've just required me to explain what a googly is.
a curveball?
Well, it's a or a doosra or anything. And that's part of the charm of the game is there are a lot of words within cricket which even the kind of most dedicated cricket fans will argue about and will have to learn over time because it is that complicated. If I had to explain cricket, you know, to someone who'd never come to it before, I was quite amused to see that on Wikipedia, it is said that cricket was first played by the Saxon children in the sort of deepest ancient history of England, in the Weald, which is sort of woodland between Kent and Sussex. And I quite like this idea, partly because cricket, of all the parts of England where cricket is played, and it is a national sport in England that is also, to some degree, pervasive in other parts of the UK. A lot of people play cricket in Scotland. Wales has its own club team, which has been successful over time. It was the most popular sport in Ireland at the end of the 19th century. But in England, it is truly a national sport. But it is played in the southeast of England, in that part of the world, around the Wealds. It's probably the kind of biggest class variety of people play it. Everyone plays cricket in that part of the world, whether you're working class, upper middle class, whatever. And it's just part of the fabric of life, as Kentish as oats houses and apple orchards and all the rest.
And if I may interrupt, there's actually a rather good history of the origins of cricket by a man who actually was a historian of the period of the Civil War called David Underdown. It's called Start of Play, and he explores the facts and the mythology that surrounds the origins of the game. It's highly recommended.
Yeah, and cricket, if you had to explain to someone who'd never seen it before, it has several unique qualities. It is played on a surface which degrades over time. So a strip of hardened earth within a kind of broader, greener sward in a kind of big oval. And the play takes place on this narrow strip, which is highly cultivated, much harder than the rest of it. See, when you start trying to explain it, it's impossible, really. But I think I'd drill it down to three things. It's one of the only sports played with any degree of popularity where the ball degrades over time, which is just not true of any other sport. The ball can be slippy in rugby or could be wet or whatever, but it doesn't get worse in quality, which is a major factor in the game. So there's a combination of time having a huge effect on the structure of the game, and then you also have this relationship with the ground because the ball touches if you want a successful delivery, which is how the game is structured, it's around a bowler bowling the ball, not throwing. It has to be done with a straight arm down this wicket. Again, once you get into it, it sounds ridiculous and it's impossible to to express.
And the ridiculousness is part of it.
The ridiculousness is part of it, just as it is among many sports which are sort of begin in England and then are codified by eccentric public school boys and, and there's all kinds of eccentricities implicit in that. And same is true of rugby to a degree. And, so time... this idea of being connected to the elements.
Yeah, the weather's very important.
The weather's extremely important. So everything comes into play. And then if I could be a bit more lyrical about it, there are very few sports that I've seen live. And, I've seen football, cricket, rugby, actually live at a professional level. Cricket is the one which, in terms of physical danger, is the most compelling. The ball is going at high speeds. The ball is also very, very hard. It's made of cork and leather, and if that hits you even at 60 or 70 miles an hour, it will give you a big bruise.
People have died.
People have died playing cricket, and people have died in my lifetime in professional cricket. And sadly, Philip Hughes, who was a Test cricketer for Australia, died a few years ago. And really tragic. And so there is an element of physical danger that's always going to be a part of the game. It actually shouldn't be eradicated from the game because otherwise the game would lose some of its distinctive flavour, its slightly gladiatorial elements. And cricket also doesn't need much explanation, I think, given that, as you've already mentioned, Paul, it is the second most popular sport in the world. Mm. We sometimes forget that in England and Europe. England is an outlier in Europe. No other European country particularly plays cricket. Within England, the game is seen to be perpetually in crisis, losing out to more commercially competitive sports like football. But in India and the subcontinent, cricket is vast. Cricketers are probably the only sports people on the planet who can compete with footballers in terms of genuine fame and stardom.
And increasing wealth as well in India through the Indian Super League. But, I mean, if we list the test-playing countries, what we mean by a test is a game that may last 5 days, has potential to last 5 days between two international teams who play potentially two innings each. If we list those countries... New Zealand, India, South Africa, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, West Indies, and of course, Australia. You recognise a theme there. It's the British Empire. It is the great imperial game, classically one that has turned on the master power of England, of Britain, almost as a means of revenge or a means of stating one's, giving one status in the light of the mother country. I mean, Australia is superb at that. It has been so successful in terms of its competitions with England, but I think that's also true of countries, particularly the West Indies during the 1970s and 80s, who had an absolutely formidable team that was based upon really fearsome fast bowling of a kind that has disappeared a little bit in recent years. But you have that tension between England, Britain, and those former colonies, former dominions there. That adds a special tension there, although actually cricket itself is a deeply social game. Within the crowd, there's no segregation, there's no people mix. It's not like football where you have opposite ends or something like that. It's an incredibly social game. On the field, certainly at club level, where ordinary people played, it's a very social activity. You know, there is famously lunch and tea, for example. A little less friendly in England-Australia test matches, perhaps. Yeah. But let's talk about this forthcoming Ashes. Australia have been in the ascendant of late. 8 years now they've held the Ashes. But there's a sense that England may be in a position, as they were in 2005, for example, to take these back. What's your take on that?
Well, let's go back to 2005, which is the first test series which I between England and Australia, which I remember. And I remember watching. And in that summer in 2005, I think this gestures on towards the way in which cricket, for many people who are sort of obsessed by it, sort of structures your life. It provides these extraordinary waypoints. That summer seems larger in my mind than many other of my childhood summers. I listened or watched as it was on free television. It was I listened or watched just about every ball of that summer's series. It was a great story, an aging but devastatingly effective Australia team full of people who would have made as kind of all time greats 11. Glenn McGrath, Shane Warne, Justin Langer.
Ricky Ponting,
of course. And I remember watching. I wanted to bowl like Glenn McGrath.
We all do.
Just beautiful to watch. But they were kind of ruthless. They were bombastic. They basically won the Ashes on the trot for a couple of decades. The narrative was England's, they're just a bit soft. They're not up for it in the kind of as cricket has become more professionalised. Australia, arguably, had a much more professional culture in terms of sports, particularly in their cricket, and that kind of told, I think. But they were just lucky. They had an amazing team that came together at the right time. But they were all getting quite old by 2005. Mm. And we had a young English team, which had a great variety within it, had extreme pace in Simon Jones,
yeah.
who was Welsh, which again illustrates that cricket is not just an English sport, even within the UK. It has, it pervades into other bits. Simon Jones, he bowled with this whippy action and could get reverse swing. And again, for people who don't know cricket, it's very hard to explain what reverse swing is without sounding incredibly arcane.
That is difficult.
You'd expect it to swing one way and it swings the other. The ball moves in flight and it moves very, very fast and very, very late. And the greatest exponents of reverse swing were the great Pakistani teams, Wazim Akram.
And Wacker Yunus.
And Wacker Yunus, who were devastating in their day and bowled with extreme pace.
And really changed the nature of bowling art, the art of bowling.
Which is, again, as you mentioned, Paul, it's a very... it gives cricket a kind of extraordinary sense of narrative, that kind of post-imperial narrative that you talked about, that it goes from the game that is so associated with kind of Victoriana. Mm. I mean, think of that poem, play up and play the game.
Yeah.
What's it, the Gatling gun, it's all this imagery of empire and it's all connected with the gentlemanly values of cricket. And then what happens is it pervades the empire, and then it is taken up with extraordinary vitality by the old imperial kind of lands, and they take the tools of their masters and give England a hiding over and over again.
And England sometimes reacts as it did with the body line, the controversial body line series of the 1930s, which was notorious in terms of the violence of the bowling. Then.
Exactly, and reacts not with entirely good grace at times. And I think that's another part of the story. But
Australians have pretty much perfected the art of sledging, as it's called, this kind of abusive mockery of batsmen.
To come back to 2005, England, they're a young team. Again, they had a really nice variety of players, and they had people coming in who would go on to be great stars. They were also, and again, coming back to this point about cricket being this kind of sport with such variety, it's an England team with a huge variety of backgrounds in it. So Geraint Jones, who's the wicketkeeper, actually hailed from Papua New Guinea.
And there was Kevin Peterson, of course, one of the great heroes of that series. And then we have that working class element with people like Freddie Flintoff and Matthew Hoggard as well. It was there, that great Yorkshire-Lancashire element that's always there. Two cricketing superpowers in Yorkshire and Lancashire. But one of the things that I remember about that 2005, and I will make you envious now, Alistair, by saying that it's the only time I've been to two complete test matches and watched every ball. First of all, Edgbaston, which is generally considered one of the greatest tests of all time. And then finally, the deciding test match at the Oval, which Kevin Peterson just about held off the pace attack and also the actions of Shane Warne, who is this great missing figure of the forthcoming Ashes, because I think he was, without any doubt, the most charismatic cricketer of recent times, perhaps even the post-war years. This mischievous, hugely likeable, roguish kind of character with his dyed blonde hair, but also with gifts as a spin bowler, which I think is the most mysterious art of all. So far, we've been talking largely about fast bowlers who beat people through pace and late movement. This man could bamboozle you with outrageous spin of balls twisting and turning. And, of course, the famous first ball he ever bowled in England in a test match, which has gone down as the ball of the century. And he will be a kind of ghost in the room throughout all of this, I think, because he's genuinely irreplaceable in terms of cricket, because he wasn't just this huge entertainer. He was also this incredibly incisive cricketing mind. Had it not been for his off-pitch antics, I'm sure he would have captained Australia, because he was that gifted as a cricketer. And it was also rather wonderful, that test match as well, particularly the final one, when the England fans, such was the respect they had for Shane Warne, that they sang at the Oval almost in unison, "We only wish you were English," which brings a tear to anyone's eye, just a memory of that. But let's talk about the forthcoming Ashes. What are we looking for there? We've talked about this New England team with their aggressive style of play that has been masterminded by the great New Zealand batsman Brendan McCullum, known as Bazball, because his nickname was Baz. So this looks like being quite a close contest. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, well, Australia, they look like a hugely efficient cricket team where everyone knows their role just about. They've got three or four pace bowlers who are right up there in terms of the pantheon of great Australian fast bowlers that they can draw on. Mm-hmm. And a spinner who is probably one of the greatest, certainly one of the greatest finger spinners ever to play the game, in Nathan Lyon. And a captain, which is unusual. Their captain is a fast bowler, Pat Cummins.
Yep, and a strangely likable fast bowler, which is odd for an Australian pace bowler.
He is strangely likable. He's also accused of sort of being woke by the Australian public, which I think it probably recommends him. You know,
All relative.
Yeah, but he... so I think they've been in the groove, but they've sometimes struggled away from home, which is increasingly a trend in test match cricket, that sides tend to struggle away from home, potentially more so than they did in the past, because tours are shorter, you have less time to acclimatise to conditions. Again, another point about cricket, it's played in such a variety of conditions in a way that, again, very few sports are true in that way.
And almost always favours the home team in that sense, who are used to the climate, who are used to the weather.
But tennis is played on a variety of surfaces, would never compare it in terms of the kind of native variety that you have in cricket. You know, playing in Sri Lanka is actually different to playing in India, which is different to playing in Pakistan.
But this goes back to the degradation point you were saying about the ball.
Exactly. And it's a battle between time, conditions, and your ingenuity about using the ball in those things, which again is part of the magic of cricket, is seeing... It almost gives you the suggestion that you can see time unfolding through the flow of the game, which is why it's brilliant for radio, because you can have it on the background and you can have that sense that a series of stories are playing out in the background to your life that will continue to play out whatever you do. And that, for human beings, I think that, without being too pretentious and glib, is quite a sort of comforting idea.
Yeah, and it's
the cricket
also,
will go on, even if we don't.
And it's also one of those things that, it is, rather like baseball, I think, in the United States, has this very rich history. And it's associated with the summer, the fleeting summer. So when you get to the traditional end of a test series in England, which usually takes place at the Oval in September. It's not this year for all kinds of reasons, but that's the traditional end. There's something very melancholy about it because it's the end of summer. It's transience, and yet I don't think it's too pretentious to say that in many ways I measure my life out in cricket seasons. I can remember who I was with, or whether it was my dad or friends that I've known. And it is about that passing of time and the brevity of summer. There's a beauty about it, there's a sound about it, there's the hum of the crowd, there's the social aspect, you know, and that's Test cricket. And talking about time, this may be, we've said this before, but it may be the last time we see two great English bowlers together in James Anderson and Stuart Broad, who really have defied time in many ways. I mean, particularly Anderson. I mean, they're two truly great players. They seem irreplaceable as well.
Partly, pretension, it's kind of written into the way English people, British people think about cricket to a degree, because a lot of cricket, the archetypal cricket writer is a guy called Neville Cardus. He's actually someone who's more interested in music early on and writes about classical music.
Classical music critic, isn't he?
Yeah, and he's at once reviled by a certain type of cricket fan because he sort of played fast and loose with the experience of cricket. He made up things and he filed match reports, I think, without defaming his memory, about matches that, which he wasn't at and things. So he was a bit of a chancer, but he also had he infused the game and fuse cricket. He kind of set the standards for cricket writing to this day, I think. And cricket writers, I think, still aspire to write to a degree like Neville Cardus about cricket. So what he did, he almost treated cricket players like great composers. Mm. So he'd write a sort of chapter-like piece on Jack Hobbs as, you know, the master. And it's like a lot of his writing, and this is why he's a controversial figure, is infected with this kind of middle period between the wars nostalgia for an England gone. Because all of the cricketers he was writing about, he saw all of them operating in a kind of fallen age. Because for Neville Cardus, the great period of English cricket was the pre-First World War period, kind of Edwardian dreamland.
Which has come to be known as the Golden Age. It's a kind of land of lost content, isn't it?
And that, I mean, that's such a huge theme of English culture in that period anyway. It's, you know, it's in art, it's everywhere. You know, it's in E.M. Forster, it's in, you know, all kinds of places. Eric Revillius, for example, you know, strange sadness precipitated by, let's be honest, very deep structural changes in English society.
Yeah. And nostalgia as
well. So that thing about cricket, which Neville Cardus sort of codified, if you like, this idea of cricketers playing in a fallen state, that there was cricket once and there's cricket now, and you can see glimmers, you know, after the death of gods of what used to be, is something I think that still there's a corner of everyone's mind who watches it, certainly in England, that always has a kind of perfect vision of what cricket should be like, which at times I think can grate with the modern variety of cricket, which is truly a sport which has escaped that picture that we have of it. It is brash, it is massive, it's hugely commercial.
And also it's changed in the nature of time. What we're talking about here is the one-day game. We're talking about T20, the Vitality Blast. What you've had is a compressed format of the game, which has changed it in huge ways. Yeah. And this is particularly associated with India, particularly, who's become, in terms of cricket, this commercial powerhouse.
Yeah, it's the centre of gravity in the game.
Yeah.
Just in terms of the amount they can sell for TV rights and all the rest. I mean, it just blows everything out of the water.
But we're not talking about test match cricket in this sphere, which is what the Ashes are about. This is, and just reiterate again, test match cricket is this potentially five-day game, played out where the cricketers wear white rather than what is known as the pyjamas of one-day cricket.
Yeah, and play with a red ball rather than a white ball.
Yeah.
And if you play cricket, you know that the white ball has a different quality to it, to the red ball. It doesn't sit in the hand in the same way. It doesn't feel the same. And I think that reflects an essential difference between the games. It's less about that battle with time. As you say, it's compressed. It's almost more like baseball in that sense.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
They even change the balls in one-day cricket a lot to keep them fresher and newer.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, occasionally in Test cricket, the ball gets very out of shape because it's gone into the crowd or hit something, and then they change the balls. But that's not an intrinsic part of the game. So, I mean, but you know, just coming back to the series that's just about to happen in England, you know, this still is a pretty much a national event. You know, people do tune in.
Yeah.
You know, again, for people abroad, you know, around the world, people certainly tune in. I think it's certainly true that on the subcontinent, people are following what's going on here.
Mm.
And England have beaten basically everyone they've come up against in the last year.
Yeah. With this new aggressive baseball, which actually owes something to the one-day game. This aggressive, accelerated style of play, which Brendan McCullum mastered in the one-day game when he was playing for New Zealand. That's Brendan McCullum, the England coach.
Exactly. And there's also a more profound element to it that read an interview with Mike Brearley, who captained England in many test matches, but was himself quite a, maybe not up to the standards that you'd expect from a professional sportsman.
But a brilliant captain and a real intellectual.
A real intellectual, someone who's operated as a psychoanalyst for years. I mean, that's actually his real career, but he also got the best out of various personalities in the English cricket team, certainly in the 80s, like Ian Botham, Bob Willis.
Yeah.
And if you want to understand cricket, it's just go into a bookshop and buy a book by Mike Brearley.
And that word test is important, I think, particularly for the batsman. The batsman is tested again and again and again because one of what is intrinsic to the nature of batting in cricket is that there's no redemption in that sense. That you, if you miss a goal in football, you can always, you'll always have another chance. But once your inning ends, it's gone. You know, and that puts tremendous pressure. And there's even been talk, and I mean, this was a very, very serious issue of suicide among batsmen because such was the psychological pressure on them that people noticed a spike among professional batsmen in terms of suicide because the mental challenges are very, very serious when they're and I think it's got something to do with that lack of redemption.
There's a huge amount of pressure. I experienced it at the weekend. I played cricket on Sunday and I bowled the. I took it on myself to.
Not
to
do for it. England, I should
No,
point
not
out.
For England. Just a social game. But, you know, the other team needed six runs to win off the final over, which is kind of six balls. Again, it's very hard to explain. and they needed six to win, which is pretty difficult. I took it. I was like, you know, I'm the man. I'm going to win it for the team. And they won off the final ball. And, I was a bit crushed, actually.
But there's a great comment on pressure, I remember. During 1948, after the Second World War, when they were still rationing, there was a great deal of austerity in England, a very great Australian team appeared, perhaps the greatest of all Australian teams, led by certainly the greatest of all Australian batsmen, Don Bradman, but also a young, sort of quite vivacious sort of team. And they had this great figure in Keith Miller, who was a great all-rounder. He liked his Beethoven, he liked his gambling. There were even rumours about a relationship between him and Princess Margaret. He was a dashing figure. And he seemed to not worry about the pressure at all. And one of the reasons he said he didn't suffer from pressure when he played cricket in those great teams in 1948 was that he'd been a mosquito pilot during the Second World War. And he said, you know, batting, bowling's not pressure. He was this kind of brash, very kind of relaxed, playboyish kind of figure. So, you know, there's different kinds of people. I also wonder if Shane Warne ever really felt pressure. I don't know. You don't know, because he certainly never gave the sense that he did. But, you know, people mask things up. So anyway, let's make a prediction. So if Glenn McGrath, the great Australian bowler, and now a commentator on the game is around, he would be predicting, as he always did, that Australia will win this forthcoming Ashes, the 73rd Ashes Test, 5-0. What's your prediction?
I think it's going to be close. And just to come back to give a bit of context to Ben Stokes and Brendan McCullum and all that.
Both New Zealanders, really.
They're both Kiwis. And if you watch, there's a great documentary about Ben Stokes on Amazon Prime, which really brought home to me how much he is really from New Zealand. which, again, is, I mean, English cricket has always embraced that side of things.
Well, it's Kevin Peterson, of course, South Africa, yeah.
What Mike Brearley says, I think this is what I was going to say before, Mike Brearley said that this idea of Bazball, this idea of an ultra-positive style, is in part rooted in a reaction to depression. So Ben Stokes, in the documentary I referred to, he is a brilliant sportsman, a genuine giant, a guy with extraordinary gifts. His father was a legend of rugby league.
And just to say, he is a great batsman, a great bowler, and a brilliant fielder as well.
Exactly. He's an all-rounder, and it's very precious in cricket to be able to do both skills. And also one of the beauties of the game, that people who are not good at batting, who are primarily bowlers, often have to bat in very pressurised situations, which adds to sometimes the hilarity, but at sometimes the extreme sort of perseverance. If you're going up and facing someone who's bowling at 92 miles an hour, and you're effectively not that much better at batting than someone who plays club cricket, that takes a lot of resilience and mental grit.
It's what the Australians would call nuggety.
Nuggety, exactly. But and Brendan McCullum also talks, the coach talks about how when he was first captain of New Zealand, he went through a period where he really lost love of the game and what might be called clinical depression on some interpretations. But Ben Stokes, I think, clearly has struggled. His father died relatively young, very, very sadly. But this idea of freedom from failure was articulated really beautifully by Ben Stokes after that 2019 Ashes series, in which he was the hero, even though it was a drawn series and Australia retained the Ashes. And to just illustrate what the Ashes are.
Yeah, we better
time,
do that.
Yeah, we better do that. The first time Australia won a series between England and Australia in England, a satirical news column.
1882.
In 1882, a satirical news column appeared, which said something like, you know, the body of English cricket has been cremated. With the Ben Stokes, Brendan McCullum thing, this idea of freedom from failure, you know, I think sports, particularly cricket, it's very easy to become very self-conscious about what you're doing, partly because, as you say, there's a lot of individual pressure. And also there's a lot of time in which to reflect on mistakes, which is, as everyone knows, once your mind gets into a sort of tizzy, it can be pretty destructive.
Once a batsman's out, they can be in their dressing room for a long time, pondering their failure.
And, you know, it can feel very cruel. Mm. And this idea that you should become a bit less self-conscious about the idea that you could fail is actually at the root of almost all sporting success. So I don't feel what these guys are saying in terms of injecting more positivity is particularly unusual in sports. But it's lovely to see people articulate it and then go out and actually do it. Because sportsmen always say, I want to go out there and express myself. It's such a modern thing. They always want to say, I'm going out and play freely, just play with freedom. But it's very difficult in practice that...
Very few people have done that. I have seen people who played freely. Viv Richards, the great West Indian batsman, was someone who played freely as far as I could see. We've mentioned Shane Warne. There are a few others, but I always got the impression that most people, you know, put themselves under pressure as well as the very real pressure that's there. And it is. It's a very, very challenging game. But I'm going to challenge you again. Who's going to win? Yeah. And who should people look out for?
I think England are going to nip it, simply because they've got very strong bowling in their own conditions. And that is such a factor. So they've got as you said, Stuart Broad, James Anderson, two of the genuine all-time greats of the game, and especially great in their own conditions. And we've got Ollie Robinson, who's a relatively young cricketer, has had an outstanding start to his international career. And
England also have this remarkable young batsman, Harry Brook, whose statistics are spectacular.
Spectacular. He's tall, bats with classical technique. So they've got a really nice mix of youth and experience. And
they've got Joe Root.
I've watched a lot of cricket. I remember watching Joe Root get his first double century, and honestly, I've never seen, if I were Neville Cardus, I'd write an essay about Joe Root because there is
waxing lyrical.
It's so easy to wax lyrical about the way he bats and the kind of elegance and grace and the kind of pure batsmanship.
I think a lot depends ultimately, as far as England's fortunes go, on Ben Stokes's left knee.
He's got a sort of knee condition. This guy, to people who are not initiates in cricket looks very frivolous and it looks kind of ridiculous and posh in English and all the rest, but it's really not. People come from it from a wide variety of backgrounds, hopefully, and come at it from, he's a real sort of hard guy, that comes from a real sporting tradition within New Zealand of really tough sportsmen, and he's playing cricket, kind of bringing that to the table. I've seen him bat, struggling with his knee, and he looks like he's in extreme pain, but he just keeps going. And I think he said it himself a couple of weeks ago, unless he can't walk, he'll be out there and contributing. But I think England will nip it. I think Australia have just played in the final of the World Test Championship against India at the Oval.
And won.
And won, which again illustrates changes in Test cricket. That creating a World Test Championship has been an attempt to bring more narratives to Test cricket beyond...
In light of the one-day game.
Exactly, beyond sort of bilateral series and make it more like a competitor to the World Cups. I don't know... whether that's been hugely successful. I find it a bit confusing the way it's tallied up. And I still only really care about the bilateral series between test-playing nations. But, like all innovations, it may... we've seen some fantastic cricket within these games, these World Test Championship finals. And I thought India playing in England, it didn't exploit the obvious frailties within the Australian batting lineup with as much alacrity as the English bowlers will.
Should be able to.
So that's my. Yeah. I think England will just nip it, but I can't. Yeah. I can't put a score on it. What do you think, Paul?
I think it will be a draw, which would, of course, mean, according to the rules, that Australia retain the Ashes. But maybe I'm just being pessimistic there. But I think it will be a very compelling series because I think, as you say, they are. Extraordinary well-matched sides. So roll on the 73rd Ashes series, which begins on Friday in the bear pit that is Edgbaston.
Yeah, can't wait, honestly.
Excellent.
It's the English summer. And, it's also part of the kind of temperateness of the English summer. There may be all weather conditions, there'll be rain delays, there'll be hot sun, cloudy days. It's all part of the kind of fabric of what it means to be in this part of the world at this time of year.
And what makes cricket so special. Well, thank you, Alistair. And I'm Paul Lay, and that was EI Talks Cricket.